be some of our previous sessions. We're going to start with the people that we have, and there should be two or three others joining as some of the other sessions break up. And I think for variety, I'll start at the far end of the table this time and introduce the three gentlemen that we have, Dr. Bruce W. Hapke of the University of Pittsburgh, Dr. Eugene Shoemaker of the California Institute of Technology, and Dr. Michael Morette of the Laboratory of Spectrometry. And you'll notice that I'm cowardly. I don't give you the French pronunciation on that, but I think that's close. Okay. And I'd like each of you gentlemen to say, Dr. Shoemaker did not have a paper today, and I'll give him the option of either talking about the paper that he presented a couple of days ago or summarizing what was has been of greatest interest to him. The other two gentlemen, I think, had interesting papers today that I'd like to have them summarized for you briefly. And if we could start with Dr. Hapke and work this way.
Okay, well, the question I've been pursuing for some time is the reason why the moon is so dark. If we look at the moon, just look at it up in the sky, and the full moon looks very bright, but actually it's very dark. It has a reflectivity of only 7%. And we know now, and I've known for some time, that most of the surface of the moon is covered with very fine powder. And that powder has a composition similar to basaltic rocks here on the Earth, and with some very interesting differences. But anyway, if you take this, there are also a number of rocks, and we believe that in some way this fine powder, or regolith, as Gene Shoemaker calls it, or soil, we believe that this stuff is derived in some way from the underlying crystalline rocks, and probably by the mechanism of impacts of meteorites and so on, which has bashed the rock and sandblasted and pulverized into this very fine material. So if you take one of these samples of volcanic rock and grind it up, you might expect that you'll get something which looks like the lunar soil. Well, you don't. The soil is very dark, and the powder you get when you grind up a rock is very light, and the question is, what else has been done to that soil besides besides just being pulverized to turn it into a dark material? And so we investigated a number of processes which might be going on the lunar surface, which you have every reason to suspect are going on the lunar surface, to convert this rock powder into a material which is much darker than its original condition. And well, very briefly, there are a number of processes which are important. One is that when a meteorite hits, it not only pulverizes, but it also makes glass out of what it was formerly a crystalline rock. So we tried making a glass out of various kinds of the crystalline rocks, and we couldn't reproduce the optical properties of the moon. And we played around quite a bit in our lab for the last year and a half, and finally the only process that we could come up with which would really duplicate the optical properties of the moon is that the material, the soil, must contain a component of material which has been deposited from a vapor. That is, something is going on the lunar surface to convert this rock into a vapor, and then instead of the vapor condensing into a liquid, and then the liquid condensing into a solid again, there's a transition directly from a vapor stage to a solid stage. And there are processes like this which are used in laboratories all the time, making solid-state devices like transistors and so on. This is used putting coatings on lenses. Process something like this is used. Well, apparently something similar to this is going on the lunar surface. And something is vaporizing lunar material, and then this vapor is deposited onto the soil particles. And this vapor is very dark. It has interesting chemical properties. And we think it can account for the reason the albedo of the moon is so low. So that's a brief summary of our work.
Dr. Shoemaker?
You want questions for
you Dr. Heppe? I prefer just to go with questions, and we can go to Dr. Moret if you like.
All right. I can talk now if you like.
Yeah, sure.
Well, the paper I gave on Monday had to do with the question of the history of bombardment of the lunar surface. Bombardment essentially by two main classes of objects. One class being those that come from interplanetary space and hit the moon. And there's a second class of objects which are just flying bits and pieces of the moon, which are thrown out by the bombardment of the previous group. We have a wide range of evidence, observational evidence, which shows that, at least at the present time, the vast majority of the extralunar objects are either comets or derived from comets, from breakup of comets. And what has been presented to us now with two landings at two different sites, two MARE sites, is the possibility of investigating the question of whether the rate of bombardment of the moon has remained about the same over geologic time, whether it is varied, whether it is increased or decreased. And we, in fact, we can attempt now to start to investigate that variation. The first blush results, which came from dating two different MARE surfaces, we have ages by strontium-rubidium methods, potassium-argon methods, and others, which enable us to date the basic time at which those surfaces are formed as lava flows. And those dates, as you've heard from others already, come out to be close to 3.7 billion years, 3.65 on the average, for Mare Tranquillitatis by the strontium-rubidium method, and about 3.3 billion years for the Oceanus Procellarum at the Apollo 12 landing site. Now, we can count the craters at these two sites, and if we count large craters, we have to deal with craters above a certain size, because if we get the very small craters, we just have the moon surface being cratered over and over again, and we have a steady state distribution. The population of small craters is just constant with time, because craters are being destroyed as rapidly as they're being formed. So if we count larger craters, particularly craters larger than about a kilometer, there we can see the total number of craters have been formed over time on each of these surfaces of different age. Now, if the rate of bombardment of the moon has been approximately constant since 3.7 billion years ago, or the time of the formation of Mare Tranquillitatis, then we should find that the ratio of the total number of these larger craters per unit area at the 12 site should stand in to the ratio at the 11 site should just be the same as the ratio of the two ages. And our first blush result was that they weren't. We predicted from the crater counts that the Apollo 12 lavas would be younger than the Apollo 11 lavas, or the tranquility-based lavas, and indeed they were. We thought they'd be about 30% younger, and it turns out they were only 10% younger. So that immediately suggests that the rate of bombardment of the moon has been declining with time. And the most obvious thing to do is to suggest that indeed it is declining, and that the total population of objects in interplanetary space that are causing these craters to be formed, both the primary and secondary craters, that's a finite population. We start out with a given number of these objects, these cometary nuclei, and they're gradually dwindling with time. And we would expect to see a decrease. In fact, if with this model, you could predict the mathematical form of the decrease. And in fact, we could go, by fitting the form of the decrease to these data points, you could even go back and predict the total number of craters that are in the cometary clouds surrounding the solar system. If you do this, and we know the rate at which comets are being lost, incidentally, at the present time. They're being mainly ejected by close passes to Jupiter, and there's a measurable rate of loss of comets now. And so if we know the rate they're being lost now, we can get the total population in that cloud. And it turns out that this first blush data suggested that the total population of cometary objects was about two orders of magnitude less than had been calculated by Oort, the famous Dutch astronomer who first presented us with this model of where the comets were. And the fact that they formed a large diffuse cloud around the solar system, residing most of the time out at a distance about halfway to the next nearest star. Earth had a calculation of how many there should be in order that we should see the ones that we do. So the lunar data seem to suggest that perhaps Earth was wrong. If Earth had been right, we would have seen no visible decay. The rate of cratering should have been more or less constant over time. Well, one way to try to test this is to get other points on the curve. We can do that by going to other places on the moon, or we can look at other processes at the given landing sites we've already visited, which are occurring at a shorter time scale, and which can also tell us about the rates. Now, in order to do that, one must have a rather detailed theoretical model of this repetitive bombardment and churning and the grinding up that Dr. Hapke has alluded to already. And one can then predict a number of things. You can predict how fast the surface would be eroded down of a rock by small particle bombardment. You can predict how long it would take to make a rock of a given size disappear altogether. You could predict what the particle size distribution of rocks should be. And so we have, in fact, looked at these, made the predictions on the basis of this theoretical model, and then tried to compare it with observational data. There are, by studying particle tracks, for example, there have been a number of papers, very good papers given at this meeting, using tracks produced mainly by iron particles ejected from the sun during solar flares that penetrate only a slight distance into the surfaces of the rocks. And it's now possible to estimate by a rather sophisticated study of these tracks how fast the rocks must be wearing down. Unfortunately, the investigators who are doing this work give us a rather broad range of numbers. In one case, one extreme, the number is about half an angstrom per year, average rate. At the other extreme, it's about 10 angstroms per year, average rate. Well, it turns out 10 angstroms per year is just the number we'd get if the rate of bombardment of the moon is constant, and half an angstrom a year would just fit the decay scheme that came from our first blush data. So that that test, unfortunately, we have to wait for the particle track people to tell us which is the right answer. We've also tried to use this model and compare the lifetimes, our predicted lifetimes of rocks, and compare these with the exposure ages, cosmic ray exposure ages. The best fit I get for that suggests that indeed the mean lifetimes of rocks that would be predicted for a constant rate of bombardment on the moon would best fit the observed distribution of exposure ages. So right now the question is not entirely resolved. I suspect from the total set of data available to us that the rate of bombardment is declining overall, not as fast as we had predicted initially, perhaps with a constant such that the rate of bombardment is declining by a factor of 2 about every 2 billion years. That's almost a constant rate, but not quite. If it is, in fact, declining by that amount, it still tells us that the total population of comets around the solar system is about an order of magnitude smaller than that predicted by Oort. There's another aspect to the question. If we go back before 3.7 billion years and we look at the abundance of craters on surfaces, for example, Mare Fecunditatis, which is the place now we're going to learn about from the Soviets tomorrow, I hope, that is a surface which has a still very much higher crater count. It would be extremely interesting to get the crystallization ages of the basalts from that surface. But if we go back into the highlands, it's clear that indeed the rate of bombardment of the moon must have, if you go backward in time, must have increased very rapidly as you go backward from the present toward the very beginning of lunar history. What we really want to do is to try to define that curve rather accurately. It is already clear that the class of objects that have made the craters after Mare Tranquillitatis time is not likely to be the same population of objects that were responsible for this very intense period of bombardment early. You can't fit the rate of decay of cratering, of the cratering rate, to one simple mathematical scheme. It appears that there are two different classes of objects, one being the comets, and the other being something else, perhaps the planetesimals out of which the planets were formed.
Dr. Moret.
Yeah, I want to apologize first for my poor English. What we are doing with the lunar bus gun, we try to reconstitute the history of the sun. You see, we are not using the lunar samples to as a probe to trace back the history of the planets, how were the planets formed. We want to know what was the sun in the past. And we have taken the challenge to look at the finest dust grain. By finest dust grain, I mean grain here, which are approximately 1,000th of a millimeter in dimension. You see, if you were looking this dust grain with an optical microscope, you could not see them. We have been using a high voltage electron microscope to look through this grain. And what we have been trying to do is to look for irradiation feature. By the mind, we have taken this grain and we have exposed them to the sun during very long period, and we were wondering what would happen in this grain. And we have made prediction, and we have been looking in the grain for detecting radiation feature. And we find out two things. You know that the sun is emitting a part of its atmosphere continuously, and this constitutes the solar wind nuclei. And we think that when we have been looking this grain, each of these crystalline grains, with a high-resolution microscope, we have found out that these grains were surrounded by a very thin skin of material. All these dust grains are surrounded by a very small skin of material. And we think that this skin results from the solar wind irradiation of this grain. And we think that we have perhaps a way to trace back the history of the sun, because the thickness of this skin will be proportional to the energy of the irradiation which produce this skin. And by measuring the skin thickness in sample exposed at different times of the moon surface, we will have perhaps a way to detect long solar cycles which have not been detected up to now. The other radiation feature that you can detect in this grain are nuclear particle tracks. These nuclear particle tracks are lines of dark contrast which happen which can be observed in this picture. I can give you some picture. What happened, this gun has been exposed to solar radiation, and solar radiation, a heavy nuclei in the solar radiation, and these nuclei were coming, for example, in all directions and have left a trail of radiation damage in this gun. And we call this trail of radiation damage nuclear particle track. And what we have found out is that the finest grain of the regolith contains very high density of nuclear particle tracks. And we have evidence which seems to show that these tracks have been produced by ions that we will call suprathermal ions. I mean, if you are looking what kind of particle the sun is emitting, you will find high energy particles which are emitted during gigantic eruption in the sun, and that we call the solar flare cosmic ray. And at the end of the energy scale, you will find the part of the solar corona that we call the solar wind. These nuclei have very low energy. And between the two, you have an energy range, really, where it was very difficult to detect particles, because it's very difficult to build up the detector to detect that kind of radiation. And we have perhaps an evidence which shows that the finest lunar dust grain have perhaps detected this missing radiation which has been detected perhaps by other means 6 months ago. And it's essentially the kind of game that we play. We took the smallest dust grain and we try to decipher the irradiation history of the sun in order to know what was the sun in the past. Do we have long solar cycle of activity, for example, instead of having the 11-year solar cycle, perhaps we have much more longer solar cycle, and we have perhaps a way to detect that. So it's essentially the irradiation history of the sun that we are trying to study, and to do that we are using the finest dust grain that you cannot even see with an optical microscope because they are too small. It's approximately all that I want to say.
Dr. Robert O. Pepin of the University of Minnesota has just joined us. Dr. Pepin, if you could give us a brief summation of your paper on the rare gas session this afternoon.
Let's see, do you want to hear about my paper or do you want to hear about the most important papers in the session? Do I get a choice?
You have yes.
I think we on the session on the rare gases, is what this afternoon session was. We considered a vast complexity of effects on the lunar surface, bombardment of the surface by the high-energy galactic cosmic radiation, by the solar wind, which Dr. Moret has mentioned, and by solar flare particles. But let me address myself to something that will be of interest to both Dr. Shoemaker and Dr. Moret. We are attempting to establish for the lunar regolith a, if you like, a time during which the cores that have been taken, particularly the Apollo 12 deep core, during which the material in that core may have been stable against turnover by impact. Now, this is a subject, of course, that while I missed your comments, Dr. Shoemaker, you probably have spoken a little bit about. And it's clear from your work that meteorite impact turns the lunar regolith over on a fairly fast time scale, at least to moderate depths, if you consider the overall time scale that the lunar surface has been in existence. It's probably been turned over to the depths that we have reached in this core, which only goes down 2 feet. That's been turned over several times in the history of the lunar surface. But it has probably been stable against turnover for some indefinite time, which we are attempting to find out. Now, there's been some discussion this afternoon and some discussion in the last 2 or 3 days about techniques that one might apply to tell how long that core has been stable. If we could put an age number on this, in other words, suppose we could say that down to 2 feet, this core has not turned over for the last 50 or 100 million years, then one of the very exciting possibilities raised by Dr. Moret's work might lead or come to fruition, and that is this. One of the problems of Dr. Moret's work is that it is very difficult in looking at a particular grain to tell when in the sun's history that grain might have been irradiated. In fact, they have scores of absolutely astonishing discoveries which are just waiting to be made if they could establish a time scale for the depth within the lunar regolith that they extract from one of their grains. Now, I will not say that our attempt to establish time scale or for stability of this core has been successful yet, but there are some promising leads in terms of measuring the isotopic composition, the relative abundance of isotopes that are sensitive to penetrating radiation from galactic cosmic rays as a function of depth. And this is theoretically capable of providing a measure of the time during which the core down to this depth has been stable. My own work has involved doing exactly the same thing, but with nuclei produced by nuclear interactions triggered by these high-energy cosmic rays. And all we can say at the moment is that it appears that this particular core has been more or less in place with no large-scale turnover for somewhere between 50 million years, possibly as long as 100 million years. We hope, with a great deal more work, to have a definite figure for this. If we can succeed in establishing this figure, it means that a grain that Dr. Moret takes from the bottom of this core has probably been on the surface about 100 million years ago, and that the history of the solar radiation that it contains may, in fact, apply to the sun 100 million years in the past and not today. And this way, of course, he can trace a time scale for solar processes as a function of time at least back that far, which isn't very far. We'd like to go back 4 billion years. We aren't deep enough in the regolith to do that yet, but there is promise with future flights that we may get as deep as 10 feet. I'd take you back a long ways, providing the core hasn't been turned over the day before the astronauts got there by a large-scale impact. That, of course, would completely foul up the chronology. Well, there are now the first evidences that we may be able to apply a time scale to this. We don't know what the time scale is yet, but it's kind of an exciting possibility. And interestingly enough, for me, my primary interest is in the early, very early history of the solar system. Most of this work is not very informative, but I am excited at this development because of the possibilities that it holds in store for Dr. Moret.
We need a time scale to be sure if the sun has been varying in the past. Yeah.
Okay, we have one participant who hasn't joined us yet, Dr. Daniel Weil. And we'll begin with questioning at this time and then come back to it when Dr. Weil arrives.
Dr. Kelly, Kevin, I heard that the upper surface before the regolith covered it up of that core had been exposed to the surface about 15 million years. Do you not?
I guess I'll have to ask you at what session you heard this, so I can estimate the evidence.
Well, it was from a fairly good source.
Oh, no, that was not the intent of my question. You see, I'm not about to discredit any answer that doesn't happen to real hours. It's just that we have so many techniques trying to establish this kind of time scale, and the situation at the moment is so imprecise that the answers are going to be extremely variant. Now, for example, one study carried out at the California Institute of Technology by Professor Rauscherberg and his colleagues suggests that the core has been stable probably for on the order of 50 million years. That's a pretty good piece of evidence based on the elements that he measures. Someone else may well do another measurement and get 15 million years, and I think we can safely say that there is a misinterpretation somewhere, but it's healthy to bring this out in the open because this is the precise state of our studies at the moment. We have discrepancies like that that will eventually get resolved. So if there is a piece of evidence that leads to 15 million years, I would very much like to evaluate it and tell you whether I think it is solider or less strong than the evidence we have that says 50, or even the evidence that I have that says 100 million years, and I'm lonely at the moment because nobody else says 100 million years.
Sample that has a very good layer of bismuth and cadmium at the very top.
Oh, that's probably it. This, that's rather shallow in the core. That's down 13 centimeters or so. And as a matter of fact, a time of 15 million years for turnover of that particular part is quite consistent with the evidence that comes out so far. We're talking about the time to the turnover to the very base of this core, which is 2 feet down.
What I was suggesting is that if you know a date for one layer, you might be able to extrapolate fairly easily.
That's what I've been trying to do, that my colleagues are not terribly unsympathetic to this attempt. I am somewhat out on a limb at the moment. I consider that it's worth a gamble because it's an exciting possibility. I think it's reasonable. 15 million years for turnover to that layer is quite reasonable, I think, on all lines of evidence that have come in so far. This game will really get hot when we go down 10 feet with the long core and try to estimate the time that it's been stable to that depth. Because then, you see, if Dr. Mark can pick a grain out of the bottom of that core and say, aha, I'm looking at the sun 2 billion years ago, then he is really saying something.
John Wilford.
Dr. Hapke, why is it that this vaporizing process darkens the material? I don't understand that.
Thank you. We're not quite sure the main results of our studies indicate that this material is not quite similar chemically to the parent rock. It's not quite similar because it's lost a little bit of its oxygen. And you don't need to take very much oxygen out of something before it begins to get dark because of various electron transfer processes which go on in the solid state material.
The oxygen then dissipates during the time it's
available. The vapor is formed, we believe, by two processes. One is by meteorite impact, which creates a little vapor every time a micrometeorite hits the soil, and the other process is sputtering by the solar wind, which when the solar wind hits the soil, it creates a little, frees some of the atoms from the surface, and these atoms fly over and stick to the next adjacent soil. And Dr. Moret and I are still discussing whether these coatings that he sees on his particles may not be some of this material which has been sputtered or evaporated off of adjacent grains. We're not quite sure what the interpretation of these things are. to return to your question, if you have a silicate material which is a mixture of different kinds of oxides and different arranged in different structures, and take away a little of this oxygen, the material very often will get dark, will get opaque, even though the parent material is transparent. For instance, you can take things like titanium dioxide, which is very transparent. In fact, it's used as the basis of the pigmentation in white paint. And you take away a little bit of that oxygen, just a fraction of a percent, and the stuff turns absolutely black. And we think something like that is going on the lunar surface, that some of the oxygen is being lost.
Would this vaporization process also be a part of an explanation for the magic component and all of
there's the fact that you can't get one from the other and can't make.
It's intriguing because if we leach the soil with acid, some of this dark component is removed and the soil begins to look like the rock. It has a similar properties as the rock. Leon Silver from Caltech, is he Caltech, Jim? Yeah. I can't keep track of all those universities there. Leaches the soil and measures the ages, and he finds that the residue left over from the leach is has an age which is more like the age of the crystalline rocks. And I, myself, wonder if this is really a coincidence.
It's fair to add, I think, on Silver's work, that the very first leach that he takes off, and leaching the fine particles, has a lead, a very primitive isotopic composition, which shows that it's been separated from the parent uranium at a very early time in lunar history. And so, in part, yes, the answer is yes. There is some, there has to be some magic component in things that are on the surfaces of grains. That's unequivocal. But it's not, it can't possibly be all of the magic component, but that's part of the story.
John Lennon?
If I understand you correctly, what you're saying is that you're getting a thin film deposition in a sputtering process, correct?
Either sputtering or evaporation.
Dr. Moret, how do you feel about this? Do you buy this? And
what I think, really, is that this this is an amorphous layer. You see, we have taken electron diffraction pattern over the grain and showing that the grain is crystalline, you see, on all its volume except on this amorphous skin. So it's really an amorphous skin. And the thickness of this skin corresponds to the range of solar wind ion in solid. So we think that this skin is directly related to the irradiation in the flux of solar wind nuclei, and we think that it's a radiation damage layer that we see. But
Are you saying then that what you're seeing is a possibility of successive depositions of thin film through the process that he's talking about?
It's perhaps when you are trying to bombard a solid with solar wind type ion. Generally, what you do, you remove material. You have a sputtering, but you have simultaneously to this sputtering an amorphization of the surface material. And from time to time, you can develop a coating, I mean that you can deposit element, but most likely, you produce only a radiation damage layer. And it seems, for me, it seems difficult to produce a coating by a solar wind implantation. The coating, as suggested by Dr. Gore, can perhaps come from the metallic elements which are sputtered away from the surrounding grains, you see, and bombard these grains, but with a very low energy. But I think that this amorphous skin is produced by the radiation damage following a solar wind implantation in the grain. But it's a very preliminary work, and you don't disagree with Abke. You see, it's perhaps a coating effect. Indeed, we are in the process of checking this coating hypothesis or this radiation damage hypothesis. I cannot answer yes or not, actually. But we don't disagree too much with Abke.
You disagree very politely.
I will say the coatings that I need to account for the optical properties are about 10 times as thick as his coating, so we're not sure we're looking talking about the same thing at all.
Shoemaker, when you mentioned comets, commentary, are you talking about things like Halley's Comet or your meteor? I'm mixed up about that you're talking about these impacts were from asteroids and...
No, explicitly, most of the material in the moon is not from asteroids. There are various sources of our direct observational evidence today for objects over a wide range of sizes. You take the objects that can be photographed with these very wide-angle cameras built by the Smithsonian Institution in a program that began almost three decades ago now, in which you have cameras with little spinning shutters so that if you have a very bright meteor, you can record the trail at two camera stations, and you chop the trail, and you can actually then do triangulation from these two camera stations, find exactly where the points are along the trail in space, and you measure, you can actually determine from this the orbit of the particle before it entered the atmosphere. You have to make corrections because it's slowing down as it comes in. And the Smithsonian group has been doing this now. The work goes all the way back to the 40s, or actually even late 30s. And they've done thousands of trails and have shown that the overwhelming majority of particles that make the ordinary meteor, the sporadic meteor that you look at if you're just out at night and look up at the sky and see one, the overwhelming majority of these things are particles which are on orbits that show they are unequivocally derived from comets. Now, we actually historically have seen, comets have been seen to break up. Biela's comet's a very famous one, broke up and produced a swarm of particles which are no longer visible except when the Earth passes through the swarm. And in fact, the Earth does annually pass through a rather broad path in which particles derived from the breakup of Biela's comet are spread out now along the orbit, and we have a meteor shower at those times. In fact, the Earth goes through a dozen rather well-defined swarms of this kind each year. And most of these swarms are identified, or the majority are identified with known comets. So we know these particles come from comets. Their orbits are cometary. If we look at the bigger objects now that have been studied in the last few years from the Prairie Network, particles I'm talking about in the first place are things that range from a microgram up to about a gram in weight. And now if we go to bigger things that are much less frequent and have been recorded on this network of cameras installed in the Prairie States, these two turn out to be objects of cometary orbits. And this takes you up into the kilogram range, or things that will make a crater that's some meters across, the typical craters that we see, small craters that the astronauts see as they walk around on the surface. Now, if we go, now we have a hiatus. It's in things that we can observe, because we have to now jump to things you can see directly at the telescope in space. And the objects which cross the Earth's orbit, which we see directly, are either the actual nuclei of big comets, or they are the things that have been called Apollo group asteroids. There's a certain class of things that don't have the halo or coma of the gas around them, which are called asteroids, but which Erpic many years ago showed were probably just degassed comets that have been in a short, very short period orbit. And now the evidence is piling up that that's what they are. They're dead comets. Now, some of them may actually be, a few of these may be asteroids perturbed out of the asteroid belt, but the majority are actually derived from the comets. So what the mechanism is that most of the comets are out in a way out away from the sun. They're halfway approximately the next nearest star from us. And they stay out there almost all their life from the time they're formed. But perturbations from passing stars will get one coming in and dropping in toward the sun. And when this happens, either they come in and whip back out and go back out into the cloud again, or if they come close enough to Jupiter, one of two things happens. If they go on one side, they get a little extra kick and get thrown clear out of the solar system, and they're gone forever. And there's a significant depletion that we actually observe over each decade of comets that get kicked out this way. If they go on the other side of Jupiter, they get dropped into a shorter period orbit, and then with progressive perturbations, they're dropped in to orbits in which they come by frequently instead of just once in the history of the solar system. In this case, we have what we call Jupiter family comets. Halley's Comet is one of these, a Jupiter family comet. And these are the things that come back and visit us frequently. Now, once this happens to a comet, once it drops into short orbit, it makes many passages around the sun. It can encounter other objects. Many of them break up. The comet rapidly disappears, actually. It loses mass each time it comes close to the sun, and particles are driven off, gases are driven off, and eventually you're probably just left with a little dead nucleus, and it'll either ultimately crash into a planet or, again, finally go the wrong side of Jupiter and start being kicked out again.
It can go either way. Now, and it looks as though the asteroids, the Apollo group asteroids, not the general family of asteroids out beyond Mars, the Apollo group objects, are some of these Jupiter family comets dropped down into still shorter orbits by close passages to the terrestrial planets. Now, if we look at the objects that dominate the impact on the Earth and the Moon, the big ones, it's these Apollo group objects. We can show from the ones we observed so far, they're the ones, it's the things that have been dropped into very short period orbit, they're the ones that really dominate the impact rate. But they're derived, most of them, ultimately from the comets.
I would like to interrupt here for just a moment. Dr. Morette told me before we started that he didn't have an engagement or a plane to catch, I believe, and might need to leave at 6. I'm going to give him the opportunity and anyone else that does need to leave at this point to do so. Do you need to leave now?
Yeah.
Okay. Fine. Thank you very much. See, Zach Strickland?
Right here. Dr. Apke, is this vapor of a uniform black cloud, or is it very, is it a varying colored, or is this deposit?
The vapor is produced, one way of producing it is by the impact of micrometeorites. That is small meteorites, perhaps not micrometeorites, but small meteorites in the sort of 100 micron to several centimeter size range. And when this hits the lunar soil, in addition to producing a lot of excitement in the soil, it also produces some glass, some melting, and also a little bit of vaporization. This cloud of vapor, which is just vaporized lunar soil, just goes squirting in all directions, part of which goes through the soil, part of which goes up into the above the moon, perhaps forms a temporary atmosphere, and rains down in the soil again. During this process of vaporization, the material loses some of its oxygen. For instance, if you try to vaporize a very high purity glass, pure silicon dioxide, SiO2, you find that the vapor that comes off is not SiO2. It dissociates into SiO, silicon monoxide, and oxygen. And the silicon monoxide is not a clear like silicon dioxide, but it's actually brownish in color, and that's what the moon is. It's a brownish color. So the stuff is raining. So in the process of vaporization, the vapor, the oxides, which are the constituent components of the rock, do fractionate and lose some of the oxygen. And so I'm proposing that these coatings, and there is evidence that we have from the analyses, that these coatings are deficient in oxygen. Does that answer your question or not?
Everything is
No, it's not over everything, because you can see some crystals in the rocks that are not coated. They're nice and clear, and they appear clean, and they're not very dark, but and they may be that way just because they're new. They haven't had a chance to get themselves covered, and they have been freshly exposed at the surface. But there are a lot of other particles, a type of particle called a microbrecia, and this is held together by a very dark brown, almost opaque glass, and we're proposing that an important component of this glass are these films of oxygen-deficient material.
Paul Risher.
You said the reflectivity of the moon was only 7%. What is the reflectivity of Earth?
Oh, it's much higher. Is it 50 or 30? I think so, yeah. It's high because of the cloud layer. This is one of the surprises, I think, that it came out of the weather satellite program and the applications technology satellites, and just how many clouds there are on the Earth. And the ground on the Earth, of course, is quite a bit darker, but just because there's such a high cloud layer, it's up around 50%, 56%, I think it's.
John
Lyman? A two-part here for Dr. Shoemaker. Could you quickly define for me the difference between comet, meteor, asteroid?
A comet's an object that's visible telescopically and is an object at distance from the Earth. And we see two kinds of rather fast-moving objects in the solar system, small objects in the solar systems, and they are empirically or observationally distinguished as to whether they have a visible coma, which is produced by gas surrounding the body and sunlight reflecting off the gas and luminescence of the gas.
Often the coma only shows up when the comet gets close to the sun. If it never shows a coma, then astronomers call it an asteroid. Now, it turns out if you look at the way of the distribution of these bodies in space, except for the so-called Apollo group asteroids, all the others follow rather well-defined orbits that are not unlike the planetary orbits, and they lie generally, most of them between Mars and Jupiter. That's where the asteroids are. The comets have very eccentric orbits, typically. So there's this distinction both in orbital characteristics as well as observation. A meteor is the visible phenomena produced by a particle as it enters the atmosphere and heats up a little cap of the air in front of it, which gets luminescent and just makes a streak of light, and it's actually an atmospheric phenomenon. That's correct to call it a meteor. Meteor means it's in the atmosphere. The meteoroid is a particle that produces that. Most meteoroids are little particles that we can show have come from comets. So a few meteoroids are also probably derived from the asteroids. A meteorite's the object after it lands on the Earth, and you can pick it up. There's a distinction because, you see, what lands on the Earth is a very selected set of things. Most meteoroids never get down, and we know from the way in which they break up in the atmosphere that they must be rather different physical objects than the few things that we collect.
Is the meteoroid correctly a meteoroid before it gets to the atmosphere?
That's right. It's a meteoroid in space. But you have to distinguish. We know what meteorites are. We get them and analyze them in the laboratory. And that does not necessarily mean the things that we find as meteorites really represent the majority. In fact, we have very good reason to believe they don't represent the majority of the meteoroids, which are most of which are different.
Okay,
sure.
Question. If I understand you, your emphasis is on meteoritic material being an impact factor, a major impact factor on this lunar surface. Is that correct?
It's material that corresponds to the things that make the visible meteors, in other words, meteoroids.
Well, if that's the case, how do you get all of the activity that one must assume is going on if the current cometary theory is correct, which says that comets are pretty fat bags of gas which have very little solid matter in them. They're frozen nuclei
let me disabuse you of the idea that it's just a fat bag of gas. A lot of a cometary nucleus is a solid. The nucleus of a comet is solid. Now, it has volatile substances in it, however, such that as it gets close to the sun and the surface is heated, gases are given off, but only when it's close to the sun. It's a solid object, and there are lots of little solid particles that come from comets, which are these meteoroids, and they're solids.
You also have to remember that ice is a perfectly respectable solid. If a chunk of ice hit the moon, it would make a beautiful crater. Let's come back over to this side, and then we'll pick up one here.
Two questions. First of all, does your theory encompass the idea that perhaps the comets could be entering our solar system the same way that you have them exiting?
That's an interesting mystery. We know we're getting rid of comets, but there are no comets which have demonstrable trajectories such that they could have come from beyond the solar system before they encountered Jupiter.
I thought there was this black hole up there that I heard a paper this summer. Very good model where this could very possibly be true.
Let our comets sink down a black hole. the fact is that...
I'm not talking about the black hole, black hole. I'm talking about an entry point which was very close to Jupiter.
I'm not sure what it is you're referring to there. But the answer to your question is that the observations that are available to us, the good ones that permit us to ask the question, could this object have come from beyond the solar system? The answer is, in all cases, no.
The other question is, you know, we observed, I think it was Halley's Comet, or maybe it was Bennett, this monstrous gas cloud, went 50 million miles across, surrounding the comet. And you say it's only when it comes close to the sun. I thought we observed it out of the ecliptic.
Yes. You'll start to see the coma, or the big cloud of gas, When the comets come, say, within about three times the distance of the Earth from the Sun, when they get about that close, they start to build up a coma, and then it may get very big and very bright as it gets close and develop a long tail, which is both gas and dust that's being swept out behind it by the solar wind and by radiation pressure on the dust.
It's kind of an interesting historical note there, that that's how the solar wind was discovered. An observation that radiation pressure from the Sun was not sufficient to produce the streaming of the coma that was observed, and it was through this that the whole idea of a particle emission from the Sun and about that energy was developed about 15 years, 20 years ago, Gene. Yeah. So now we're all spending lots of time studying it, and that it happens to be through that avenue that it was discovered in the first place.
I'd like to interrupt the discussion of comets for a moment, if I could, to introduce our most recent arrival, Dr. Daniel Weil of the University of Oregon, and Dr. Weil's paper this afternoon dealt with Rock 13. Dr. Weil, if we could, I'd like to have you give us a brief summation of the content of your paper and any other item that was of particular interest to you in the session you participated in.
Sure. I feel a little bit like the guy who's always introduced as his wife's husband. I'm introduced as a man who analyzed Rock 13. I think that there has definitely been a tremendous amount of curiosity and also some legitimate scientific interest in this Rock 13. And I'm a petrologist, that is to say, a form of geologist. And what I found fascinating in Rock 13, of course, was the fact that all along, or at least ever since Apollo 11 rocks started coming back, petrologists have said that, by and large, some of the processes that go on Earth and that we're familiar with that give rise to various types of igneous rocks have also been going on the Moon. For instance, the normal scheme of differentiation, as we put it, on Earth goes from more basic rocks to more acid rocks, that is, those that contain less silicon dioxide to those that contain more and more. That is, as you take a basic liquid and as it starts to crystallize, the liquid that remains is progressively more silicic, more SiO2 rich. And we had seen these kinds of things on a very small scale in Apollo 11 rocks. And I think that for the first time we're seeing on a at least somewhat larger scale in Rock 13, because Rock 13 contains, in a sense, the culmination of this differentiation process from basic to acidic, and because it contains a good granite-type rock. And granite is about as far as one goes, actually, on the differentiation scheme. So for the first time, we're seeing it in a concentration great enough, I think, to get excited about, and maybe more important than that, in volumes that are large enough to at least, I think, greatly increase the possibility of next time, say, we go to the highlands or some other place, at any rate, that we will find fairly large bodies of granitic-type rocks. It's a possibility, a stronger one now, I think, because of the discovery of Rock 13.
There was a feeling after Rock 13 came back that good things always come in small packages, that is, less than 80 grams. And this feeling was so strong that we've modified our sampling procedures for future missions, and we're going to try to bring back buckets full of Rock 13s by deliberately trying to sample rocks from thumbnail size up to half dollar, silver dollar size across. It actually makes sense to do this because when you bring back a single large rock, you bring back one particular type of material. That's not always true because some rocks are brushes and mixtures, but by and large you are. Whereas if you bring back the same mass in 100 smaller rocks, your chances of turning out something exotic are very much better. So we're in the process of developing what I must call a simple garden variety rake to collect smaller rocks on the lunar surface, pop them all in the bag, and bring back several hundred rocks in the size range up to the size of Rock 13 in the hopes that lightning will strike again.
Right. Well, I think in that connection, really, if you're quite right, it's not really the size of the rock, at least beyond the 80-gram level, that matters so much. But one of the things that I think was brought out at this meeting is that people who are used to studying rocks in the field, that is, geologists, are getting worried that, in fact, now we've got this tremendous amount of information from various rocks that have been picked up as small rock fragments, but we have yet to go to what the geologist calls a rock outcrop. and to hack off either a small or a large piece of rock. And I think the first time we're able to do that, we'll really, I think, increase our understanding of the rocks by at least an order of magnitude.
Okay, we're open to continuing the questioning, I guess, on comets or other subjects. Any further questions? Okay.
How did you know that the granite part of Rock 13 is 4 billion years old and the dark part is 4.5 billion years old? Is it? Was that in your analysis or how?
No, that was not in our particular analysis, but this was done mainly by rubidium strontium age dating, where people were able actually to separate the light-colored or granitic portions of the rock and measure these isotopes and get a certain age for that portion of the rock, which turned out to be about 4.0 billion years, and then making some valid assumptions, taking the ratio of the strontium isotopes and the rubidium content of the rock as a whole, and combining it with these assumptions, getting what's called a model age of about 4.5 billion years, I believe.
I think there's perhaps a misapprehension about this that Dr. Weil just referred to. The whole rock, not just the light and dark parts, the evidence is quite good, was formed at about 4.5 billion years, and then that rock has been part, the strontium ice and rubidium systems within that rock have been partly homogenized later at the 4.0 billion year time as an event at that time. And both, you get the age by both techniques, but in one case you look at actual rock components, a lithic chunk here and a lithic chunk there and another one here, and you look at the, you get at what's called an internal isochron for these chunks, and that gives you the 4.5 billion year age. But if you take the minerals out of each of those chunks, any one of them will give you the 4 billion-year age. So you measure two different things.
I think another way to put that, Gene, would be the last thing that happened on a drastic scale of Rock 13 happened 4 billion years ago. Right. But the material from which it's made clearly came into existence about 4.5 billion years ago. But things happened to it for the first 500 million years. Partially remelted, got hot, systems equilibrated. But as in its final form, it's the last thing that happened to it, there was a great import to it. It was about 4 billion years ago.
I'd like to add something. Since the analysis of Rock 13, there's been a lot of speculation about the possibility of large areas on the moon being granitic. I'm not sure how facetious some of this was, but the optical properties, and particularly the measurement of the optical properties of the moon from Earth-based telescopic observations, has something to say about this. And in order, I'd like to say I would have a very, very difficulty in understanding how areas even as light as the highlands, they're still quite dark, could be as dark as they are unless they contain significant amounts of iron, which would be something like the severe 7 analyses. So if you want to call a material which has as much iron as the severe 7 analyses do a granite, then I would be perfectly happy. But if it is a granite, it's going to be a rather peculiar granite with iron in it.
No, I guess we wouldn't, in fact, be able to call that kind of rock granite, but I think there may be, you know, reasonably large areas of granitic-like rock mixed.
There may be, but I feel rather strongly that it won't be. It's not the sizes which are readily observable by telescopic observation. In other words, hundreds of square kilometers of this stuff.
Oh, no. Well, I mean, you know, when I said that we raised the probability of finding granites on the moon, I mean, we went from something that could be measured in terms of, you know, 10, 20 microns thick accumulations of granitic-like material to what it is in Rock 13.
Right.
And to be quite truthful, that's about, you know, you get pods of granitic-like material in it that maybe are several millimeters across. So we've raised it an order of magnitude or more, but it still isn't in the 100-kilometer range by any means.
You're fairly sensitive to dust overlay, too, those measurements.
Yes.
So a little dust over the surface would.
But if the dust is mainly locally derived,
then it should
bring the genes
show
down,
the same composition.
Yeah.
Ed DeLong?
Why don't you take John first? I think he wants to follow on that. Okay. And I'm going somewhere.
I've seen granite on Earth, but now I'm beginning to wonder what is the definition of granite. If you can have a broad definition, tell me what the definition of granite is.
Like most things, there are a number of ways of defining it, but it's defined, first of all, by the chemistry of the rock, and it's a rock which is relatively rich in silicon dioxide component, SiO2, would contain at least, say, 65% SiO2, along with all the other things normally in rock. Yeah, roughly. And then most geologists would define it, and I'm not sure that in this context on the moon that that's terribly important to give you what the geologists would define it as. But anyway, they would also put some limitations of what kind of minerals form from this chemical system, and those minerals would include, the major ones would be quartz and what is called an alkali feldspar. An alkali feldspar is a compound of potassium, sodium, aluminum, and silicon. Fairly complicated structure. But those two are the main mineral components, feldspar and quartz of a granite.
And
oh, yes, certainly some iron and some iron-containing minerals are present, but usually in subordinate amounts.
Of course, it may be a creepy granite in
3 months. Well, I'm sure it is.
Since Ed DeLong has deferred the follow-ups, I'll come over here and get one and then come back.
It's gone, I know it's gone right by me several times, but what is the significance from the standpoint of the origin of the moon, or what we're going to the moon, or why we're going to the moon, what is the significance of having granite there, or finding granite?
Well, I'm sorry, was that addressed to me? I hate to be put in the position of, you know, speaking for anybody else as to why we go to the moon, and I quite agree with you, we don't go there to find granite. On the other hand, I think we go there to a large extent because we're curious. And
yeah, tell us what granite means.
Well, for one thing, if it's there in reasonably large amounts, it means that those igneous processes, that is, those processes that involve the melting and recrystallization of rocks that we're familiar with on Earth, are operating at least to some degree on the moon. And I
think you can go farther than that and say that not only do they occur on the moon, they occurred on the moon right at the beginning, and that is of great interest in terms of the origin of the continental granitic plates on the Earth, and which has been a long debate in geology. And what we've learned from the moon shows that indeed the Earth, there may have been a significant amount of granite generated on the Earth by these very magmatic processes we're talking about, and we may have formed a semi-granitic crust. That won't be all granite, but there'll be granitic components in it at a very early stage. And that's indeed very here on the Earth. It could have happened here. See, there's been a big debate in geology as to whether you have to cycle and separate the minerals by sedimentation to make most of the granites, or whether they could have come about initially by igneous processes. Whether the crust grew gradually with time, or whether most of this differentiation is something that may have occurred initially, and all you've done since then is recycle these things.
Ed?
Well, to get to a somewhat different area, tomorrow we're going to hear about yet a third of the lunar seas, and I just wonder if you gentlemen would address what it is you hope that you may learn from this presentation, what some of the things you'll be looking for are.
I'll tell you one thing I'm extremely interested to find out about the samples from the sample obtained from Mare Fecunditatis. That is the Mare surface with the highest crater density. So on a crater, on a flux age, or bombardment age, we would guess that to be the oldest, and it would be extremely interesting to get a strontium-rubidium date for that surface. In fact, that would really start to tie down this question of the rate of bombardment of the moon over time, how that's varied over time. That's a key point.
There's a little bit of a problem there, because unfortunately this is a dust sample, and
a little bit of, well, or maybe a nice little exotic loony fragment too. And but it's tough. It's tough in the dust because at least model ages for the dust have all come up to be rather high on all two cases that we know about now. I think the general importance of tomorrow's presentation, or just the fact that we have a third sample, is that it's a third sample. I suppose from the point of view of those of us who love to do correlations so much, through 2 points, you can do perfect correlations, which are almost always wrong. Through 3 points, you can't usually draw straight lines anymore unless your theories happen to have been right with 2 points, which is unusual. So the third point is, one could argue, the most important point at this stage for understanding all sorts of chemical differentiation processes, elemental abundances, the whole works. We'll get the third point ourselves eventually, but then, of course, we'll have four. So it comes at a very critical time.
Well, I think that there's a fair chance if you could get a large enough piece, that there is a fair chance to get a large enough fragment to date by strontium-ibidium technique in that sample. But I'm not sure the Soviets can do it.
Yeah. Oh, no. We won't address ourselves to that, Gene. Do you happen to know whether there is such a fragment there?
Well, just on the basis of size distribution for the regolith, you could hope. I think I don't know the exact volume, and that's going to be very interesting to find out. But if the volume runs to, say, a few tens of cubic centimeters, then there's a shooting chance you get some fragments that could actually be done here in laboratories in the United States.
And Jerry Wasserberg will tell you that the fragment doesn't have to be very big, as long as he can see it.
Zach Strickland, that's beside you.
Dr. Shoemaker, since you mentioned this, how about just enlightening us on what you all know about the Russian sample so far? That would help us, I think, in preparation for tomorrow.
Well, I'm ignorant, so I'm going to be sitting there right in the front row listening. And maybe some of these other gentlemen know more. But I think, unless maybe Homer Newell can say how much information has really been received in the United States about these samples.
I'll leave it to the Russians to disclose their results, but I can assure you it'll be an interesting paper.
Dr. Newell, how much already has found its way into general scientific circles that people here might be aware of?
That better than I.
Well, I may not be a fair sample. I've only heard things sort of third hand, like somebody saw something in TASS, actually, this is going to be an extremely interesting session for all of us, and we're really hoping that Vinogradov and the delegation with him will really be prepared to tell us a lot of things about these samples.
I believe there are a few numbers out. As I recall, Paul Gast, on the first day of the session, did have a few slides where he had specific analyses from that sample, just a very few of them. I don't think that one could make significant arguments on any small differences that might have existed in the chemical analysis that he was concerned with. Any small differences between those and Apollo 11 and Apollo 12 soils, that I know they'd be elaborately discussed tomorrow. But I think a few such points are available since we have seen them.
We got one more question up here.
Yes, one more question about the granite. Is it possible that this rock 13 was just strictly a very local thing, formed, that has no lunar-wide significance? It just happened, and that the granite could have been formed by an impact at that one spot rather than... I was wondering why you expect to find this granite all around the moon.
Well, I think that's a very good question. I didn't mean to imply, in fact, that I did expect. All I said was that what we found in Rock 13, I think, greatly increased the probability from rather low, maybe, to medium now, of finding fairly large bodies of granite. But formed locally, we know, in the Apollo 12 landing site. That, I think, is pretty well ruled out by the chemistry, the ages, all sorts of things. So it would have had to have formed locally somewhere else, presumed maybe in a highland area, and then been transported to this site. Now, whether it was formed locally in very small batches or large batches, it's impossible to tell right now.
If you
on 14, 15 or so, yeah, you don't find any more of these type of rocks, then do you have to go back and rethink about the Earth, its crust being a slow-forming thing or something like that? Is that the implication?
I think part of the answer to the question is that in the fines, in the so-called soil, at the Apollo 12 site, some parts of that have up to about 20% of material which corresponds approximately to the dark part, the darker parts of Rock 13. So that at least one component we see together with the dark and light in Rock 13 is evident, and that's not a freak, just that one rock. But there's a lot of it that's being transported or ballistically diffused by into the Apollo 12 site. So it means somewhere out there, probably in the highlands, there's a fair amount more of this kind of material. How much of the very light fraction, the light component in Rock 13 might be, is a little different question. But it may well be that some of this is represented in a very regional deposit that we know around the moon as the Falmaro Formation, which appears to be an ejecta deposit from the Imbrian Basin. And we're going to land on that, hopefully, early next month. So there's a fair chance we might see a lot of objects related to Rock 13 there.
We've been going on for quite a while now. I'd like to end it here if we could.